You're listening to The Pod Delusion. This is an extended interview with Cory Doctorow from episode 188 of The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a news magazine program about interesting things, from science to culture to politics, all from a skeptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more about the podcast at poddelusion.co.uk. The annual Sense About Science lecture was held on the 13th of May 2013. This year's speaker was Cory Doctorow, science fiction author, one of the founders of Boing Boing, and general knowledgeable dude about all things internet. Cory was kind enough to take some time to talk to us about some of the themes in his lecture. You made a great metaphor, but the internet is the nervous system for the 21st century. And later on, you mentioned the thing about IBM, about not needing more than four computers in the world. From that kind of perspective, do you think we know how integral the internet's going to be to our lives and to the world? Or is it going to be surprising from year to year how more and more we use it?
Well, like I've said before, I think science fiction writers who try to predict the future are like drug dealers who sample their own product. So I don't know that I'm prepared to make a prediction about that, except to say that in general, the future is a lot weirder than we think it is. You know, there's this old saw that the job of a science fiction writer is to examine the car and the movie and invent the drive-in and infer the sexual revolution. And, you know, that seemed like a really, I think it was Gardner Dozois who said it, and it seemed like a really choice quote. And then I realized one day that actually the major impact of the car and the movie wasn't the sexual revolution. It was the fact that to get laid, you needed a driver's license, which meant that for the first time, people started carrying photo ID. And basically, this is the origin of the database state is in the car and the movie. And that third order effect is so much weirder than the second order effect and so much more profound and so much more lasting. And the sexual revolution is over, right? And no one talks about the sexual revolution anymore, but we are still living through the repercussions of the database nation. And it's probably going to change society in ways that dwarf the sexual revolution, as profound as that was. So I think that when we think about where the future of the internet might be, we tend to get stuck, you know, imagining our horseless carriages, you know, just like today, only more so. Not genuinely different. Not in the sense that, you know, Brian Eno talks about in The Oblique Strategies, where he says, imagine being the first person to try not doing something that no one has ever thought of not doing before. You know, what does it mean to do an encyclopedia without an editorial board? What does it mean to do an operating system without a company? You know, apply that kind of thinking, that kind of networked thinking to stuff like education, aviation, civil planning, war, you know, molecular biology, space travel. And then you start, and that's where you start to get into, oh yeah, no, the internet might do things that are profound and weird and unimaginable.
Jumping further ahead in the talk, you drew a comparison between how the user is legally allowed to use the content on CDs, DVDs, and then also Blu-rays, and how each is more restrictive than the last. That whole bit was really fascinating. Could you be able to kind of outline how that happened or how it's happening?
It's a little parable about what it means to create a rule that says that it's illegal to break a lock, even if you're not doing anything illegal when you break the lock, and even if the lock is on something that belongs to you. So DVDs are locked. They only play on licensed DVD players. To get a license to build a DVD player, you have to promise to implement all kinds of restrictions. Those restrictions include things like respecting region codes and making sure that people can't skip the unskippable adverts and things that really don't have anything to do with piracy. They're just, you know, sort of profit maximization schemes. CDs are functionally equivalent to DVDs. They're the same kinds of discs, read with the same kind of lasers, made in the same kind of factories, read in the same kind of drives, but they don't have the lock. And we have this law, the EU CD in the UK, the implementation of the UCD in the UK. In the US, it's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. In Canada, it's Bill C-11. And that law says that it's illegal to break a lock, even if you're not breaking the law in any other way. And so since CDs were invented, people have come up with all kinds of amazing new things that you can do with them. But since DVDs were invented, because all innovation is controlled by the consortium that makes the DVD locks. You can only unlock a DVD with their permission, and they won't give you permission if you want to add any features they think might undermine their profits. Nothing has happened with DVDs. DVDs have stagnated. And a little thought experiment I run is, imagine it's 1996, and you go into a Tower Records or a Virgin Megastore, and you buy £1,000 worth of DVDs and £1,000 worth of CDs. This is the debut of the DVD. 1996. You stick them in a vault, You wait 10 years. You take them out of a vault. Now, normally, if you buy something computer-related and you stick it in a box for 10 years, when 10 years have gone by, it's not only worthless, it has negative value. You have to find some way to dispose of it as e-waste. But in this case, something really funny has happened. With your CDs, in the years between 1996 and 2006, your CDs have accumulated value because since there are no locks on them, and so since it's legal to add features to them, CD players can now rip CDs. And once you can rip CDs, you can do all kinds of things with them. You can hash them up. You can stream them. You can archive them. You can put them on an iPod or another music player. You can listen to them while you swim on your waterproof digital music player. You can make them into alarm tones and ringtones. You can put a huge library of them in your car. You can share them. You can back them up. You can burn them onto new CDs. You can do all kinds of things. And that's the dividend that your CDs have played. But it's not only that DVDs have not had a new feature added to them in that 10 years. You know, when you take your DVDs out, all you can do with them is the things you could do with them when you put them in the vault, which is play them. But since 1996, since DVDs were introduced in the 17-odd years since DVDs were introduced, not one new feature has been added to them. Now, all of the value that was latent in those DVDs, that's value that has been stolen from us. It's been picked out of our pockets in the 20 years since DVDs came along. And it's been picked out of our pockets by the combination of the cartel that controls the DVDs and the law that gives the cartel's wishes the force of law. The fact that the state has promised to use as many of the taxpayers' pounds as it takes to make sure that nobody adds any new features to a DVD. And that DRM is now present in all of our devices. It's in our smart meters and our iPads and in our car motors. All of these are now locked with software locks that have the force of law that prohibit us removing them, even though we may only want to do legal things after we remove them.
You mentioned WIPO and several of the treaties. And in combination with things like SOPA, RIPA, C10, the Digital Economy Act, are these all kind of related to WIPO, or are they completely separate? Like, I'm wondering how the international and the UN treaties work in terms of WIPO.
What these treaties tend to do and what the laws tend to do is reinforce themselves. So the eldest one is probably the Berne Convention, which Victor Hugo is responsible for. And the Berne Convention guarantees copyright protection for works without what are called formalities. And formalities means things like registering a copyright. And that sounds like quite a good idea, but then you realize that what it means is that it's very hard to figure out who a copyrighted work belongs to. In the U.S., when copyright only accrued in the face of a registration, it meant that if there was anything you wanted to license, you could figure out who to license it from because you had to register a work to get a copyright for it. And it was cumbersome and onerous, but it needn't be like that. I mean, we can register a new Tumblr with about 9 keystrokes. It should be, you know, just about as easy to register a new copyright. So the Berne Convention requires a 50-year term of copyright and copyright without any formality. And then the WIPO Copyright Treaty, the WIPO Phonograms and Performers Treaty, and the World Trade Organization's TRIPS vision, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property something, all require that signatories put in Berne. So in order to be a WIPO WCT signatory, you have to also have agreed to Berne. And now what we see in new international instruments like ACTA, and like TPP, the EU-Canadian Free Trade Agreement, the EU-US Free Trade Agreement, the US-Australian Free Trade Agreement, the US-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the US Free Trade Agreements with the Andean Nations, and so on, and the US-Korea Free Trade Agreement especially, are what are sometimes called TRIPS Plus or WIPO Plus provisions that say in order to sign up to the WCT or to sign up to ACTA, you have to agree to implement the WCT plus something, plus more. And what that means is that if your national government, so these treaties are negotiated usually not by the legislature, but by the executive, so by the prime minister's office, by the president's office. And so if the U.S. trade representative or the Canadian trade representative or the EU trade representative signs you up to this, and then later on your legislative body, your elected body, not an appointed bureaucrat, but the elected body decides to repeal some component of the Berne Convention, by changing your relationship with the Berne Convention, you are yanked out of the WTO, you're yanked out of the WPPT, you're yanked out of the WCT, you're yanked out of ACTA, you're yanked out of the EUCD, you're yanked out, I mean, so all of these other treaties fall apart. And so what it means is that if there's something in one of those other treaties you want, like, you know, the free trade in soybeans, or, you know, the common currency on the in the EU, or some other element that you want, you have to be prepared to give all of that up to renegotiate any component of the deal. So the deal, it's like it's been sort of buried over and then bricked up and then cemented over and then had a manhole plate riveted on top of that. And then on top of that, they're just piling, you know, enormous slabs of marble and, you know, strontium 90 and plutonium and, you know, marmite. You just, you have to remove all of this stuff to change any element of any of it. It's a bit like some mad survivor's raft that's been lashed together with thousands of you know, string and belts and netting and whatever you had, and everything is sort of lashed together as many ways as you can so that nothing can be cut. So it has the effect of, as our relationship with copyright is changing more and more, as, you know, our apparatus for copying works becomes more and more sophisticated and widely available, our ability to reflect those changes in law grows less and less, becomes less and less available. And so this is like a catastrophe if you actually care about copyright law. You know, I make my living from the copyright industry. I want to have sensible copyright laws that regulate the industry that I'm part of. And those laws, our rules can't be updated because they've been kind of lashed to this, you know, late 20th century and in the Berne Convention, you know, late 19th century version of how people relate to copyrighted works. And though that tying together has been completely frozen and we can't ever untangle it, it's been snarled up in this horrible knot.
Has there been any country able to escape this? Like, I was just thinking of the recent acts, but if it's that kind of an ensnarement, have there been any countries that have escaped that? Or is it basically if you want free trade or more open trade, you have to agree to this?
So you really hit it when you said free trade, because this is tied into the WTO, and because if you want to buy or sell around the world, you generally have to be a WTO signatory. Yeah, it's kind of locked into the WTO. I mean, there are countries that are outside these agreements, but they're countries like Iran, you know? And so, yeah, the WTO sort of ties it all up. What's interesting about this is not who accedes to it in law, but who can be held to it. So, for example, China very famously doesn't adhere to most of international copyright norms. You know, the state is intimately related in a lot of copyright infringements. And even where it isn't personally directly responsible, it turns a blind eye to it. And in theory, like, the rest of the world could say to China, well, China, you know, because you allow for the unlimited reproduction of Happy Meal toys, you know, we're cutting you off. But the rest of the world depends on, you know, this kind of railgun loaded with shipping containers filled with electronics and Happy Meal toys to be fired out of the port of Guangzhou. Like, kind of, you know, there's one container every second on average 24 hours a day that goes from Guangzhou to L.A. And so, you know, the rest of the world can't really afford to say to China, oh, you know, respect copyright or we won't trade with you anymore. So, you know, the idea that this would somehow usher in a kind of new oil, right? That was the saying when these treaties came into being, that intellectual property is the new oil, so that the West would acquire oil essentially in the form of designs and in the form of ideas and patents, and that the rest of the world would pay it for this oil, has been a complete failure. Instead, what's ended up happening is we've undermined the fabric of the internet. We've turned the creative industries from industries that were in the business of making art into industries that are in the business of making lawsuits. We've made it completely impossible to enforce any kind of sanctions against states that don't respect the West's copyrights or patents. And we've also dismantled all of our manufacturing apparatus, so there's no way we can wean ourselves off of Pacific Rim manufacturing, although 3D printing may take a shot at it, as will robotics. But, you know, that opens up its own can of worms, because as we covered in the Sense About Science lecture, you know, we can essentially use automation to remove labor costs from manufacturing so that it costs the same to make something wherever you are in the world. All that does is further unbalance wealth around the world so that the rich get massively richer and everyone else has no job to do and gets, you know, progressively poorer and there's nothing in the middle. And that's not a sustainable economy either.
One of the things you just touched on a moment ago was the idea of just massive amounts of lawsuits. You mentioned in the lecture that there wasn't much suing over things like DVDs, but now with Blu-rays, with the coming of Blu-rays as a massive popular thing, that they've built up a war chest. Is this basically to take people to court for copyright infringement?
Yeah. So to license the DVD keys, it was very cheap. You just had to sign up to a set of rules. And what that meant was that the licensing body never had much of a budget to sue people. So they really had to pick their battles, and they didn't do much of it. With Blu-ray, they really raised the cost. And when I talked to the people who were running the Blu-ray licensing stuff when I was involved in DRM standard setting, they candidly admitted that the purpose of this was to raise a litigation war chest so that if companies started to do what companies had done with DVD players, which is to make DVD players first that were easy to render region-free and then just region-free DVD players. You remember, at first it was like you bought a DVD player, usually like an off-brand DVD player, and then you would go on the internet. It would say like, you know, take your remote and press up, down, left, right, start, you know, A, B, A, B, and then your DVD player becomes region-free. And then eventually that was replaced with players where like the sales clerk would just tell you to do this. And then that was replaced with players that just were advertised as region free. And now you can buy players that are region free in the high street. With Blu-ray, they didn't want that to happen. They wanted to make sure that when little companies in the Pacific Rim just popped up making Blu-ray players that were not compliant with the region coding rules, that they could immediately, you know, hire private eyes, track down who ran those companies, bring actions in their country of origin, sue them into the ground, sue the high street vendors that carry the technology, sue the distributors that brought it into the country, basically put the fear of God into anyone thinking about making region free, and just make sure that region free never came in with Blu-ray, that compliance remained with Blu-ray, and that, you know, the longer that they're collecting license fees from companies that want to make Blu-ray players, the bigger that war chest gets. So they have a great big war chest to sue people with. And I think that's why we haven't seen region-free high street products from Blu-ray.
Maybe kind of slightly related, but with the launch of Xbox One, there's been kind of rumors that suggest that it's going to be potentially restrictive when it comes to used games. Is this kind of the same thing? They're just trying to lock down a format.
Well, so yeah, selling a game is not illegal, right? But if the device is locked so that you can only play a game that's used by unlocking it, and if unlocking the device is illegal, then you can effectively end the trade in used games. So it's effectively a form of private law, right? Normally the way copyright law is written is Parliament sits down and figures out what rights the public should have and which rights investors and creators should have. And they say things like, well, you know, investors and creators should have the right to sell their works and make sure people can't copy them, but they don't have the right to control backups, or they don't have the right to control rental, or they don't have the right to control sale after, you know, second sales, the sales after initial purchase or whatever, right? You know, people who sell you the DVD can't tell you how many people can be in your sitting room when you watch it, how big your family can be. Right. But then you go and you put a software lock on the player and you back it up with one of these license agreements. So you can only unlock the software lock legitimately by signing up to a license agreement that binds you to all kinds of conditions. And now you can say, OK, well, anyone implementing a video playback for the Xbox has to have a camera that works, that has some secure path to the device, and has to implement a head count algorithm that tries to do face recognition, count the number of people in the room, and not play if there's more than seven people in the room, right? And so that's a form of private law. Parliament never said you get the right to tell people how many people can be in the room. And in fact, what Parliament does say is that all the rights that aren't given to rights holders are reserved to the public. But by adding DRM, and it doesn't have to work very well, right? It only has to be, you know, a colorable claim of DRM. You can effectively stop anyone from making a product that extends the functionality beyond that which is in it. In the same way that, like, you know, imagine you had a fridge where the option was with a butter dish or without a butter dish. But it was the same fridge, and if you chose without a butter dish, the butter dish was screwed shut with a special screw with a special head. And then the state criminalized making screwdrivers that could open the butter dish. Right. Well, fridge manufacturers be crazy not to avail themselves of this because, you know, it's a simple way to kind of charge people for stuff that they could get otherwise for themselves for free. But it represents a form of private law. It creates butter dish right. And you know, if butter dish right is a good idea, let's have Parliament debate it. But let's not have it created through the back door. Let's not have this series of rights that are effectively rights to your private property. Right, rights about the devices that you own, created that take some of your rights and your private property and give them to industry and take them away from you. You know, let's have our rights and private property be only taken away after debate and the passage of laws and some transparency and very infrequently, if ever, and not wholesale through the addition of a rule that just says, anytime you put something that looks like DRM in a device, all the rights that the person has to their private property are up for grabs.
Why do you think digital rights, or at least what seems to be the end result of these laws created to protect things like copyright, are treated different than like normal civil rights? Like, you gave some excellent examples of the butter dish one. There was one about water purification technologies in your lecture. And the pathway and the implications of law are exactly the same, but for some reason they're treated completely differently, and laws that infringe on us on a massive scale with digital rights aren't even really contemplated in private or civil law.
So I guess there's lots of different potential reasons for this, and the reasons are probably as varied as the lawmakers. I think one is that lawmakers are accustomed to thinking of complicated things as being special purpose and inherently regulatable. So cars are pretty complicated. They're special purpose. I mean, they're general purpose in that they're a thing that gets you from A to B, but they're special purpose relative to something like a wheel, right? And so, like, if I show you evidence that car phones cause accidents, lawmakers might be tempted to pass a rule that says you can't put phones in cars. And, like, we might disagree about whether that's a good rule or a bad rule, but that disagreement wouldn't be based on the idea that it's not a car anymore if you take the phone out of it. But wheels, on the other hand, if I were to, like, show you that burglars always use wheels on their cars to get away from burglaries, no one would say remove the burglary feature from wheels, right? We understand that, like, there is no effective way to do it, and an attempt to do so would cause, like, disfiguring violence to the underlying utility of wheels. Computers are a really special, and the internet are a really special case because they are, on the one hand, general purpose. All the instructions that we can express symbolically can be run by all the computers we make. All the messages that we can encode can be passed from any point to any place else on the internet using any protocol without any third party intervening. Right? That's what, like, that's the definition of the internet. That's the definition of a computer. So on the one hand, they're general purpose, but on the other hand, they're very complicated. And lawmakers' heuristic, their intuition about the inherent regulatability of these things fails them. So they say things like, make me a computer that runs every program except for the one that illegally copies copyrighted works, not realizing that there is no theory that gives you that computer, and that the closest we can come is a computer that has spyware on it that watches all the things you do, waiting to see whether or not you're making a copy. And if you are, it tries to intervene. You know, it says, I can't let you do that, Dave. So that's one of my theories. Another theory, though, is this business of information being the new oil. And this was a real rallying cry. We had this idea of an information economy for a long time. Toffler wrote about it in the 70s. You know, this was the future of stock and trade, the information economy. And it's not immediately clear what an information economy is, but if you kind of follow the logic of the words out, you get an economy, buying and selling information, right? So it must be a thing where you buy and sell information. And the kind of use cases that we heard for information economies for the longest time were all about finally dividing the use of information into smaller and smaller pieces, smaller and smaller offers that could be made so that we could price discriminate within audiences and give everybody an offer that was uniquely suited to their circumstances. In the same way that we can, you know, slice the way we price out plane tickets to try and price a plane ticket for a business traveler who's not paying for her own travel, price it very high, but take a family trip where the family is very price sensitive and price it very low, and maybe even have those travelers sitting next to each other on the plane and somehow figure out who's traveling where and how and how to make price it so that you get the optimal from the perspective of the seller, you get the optimal price from everybody. And so we had this idea that you could like sell someone the right to read a book for a day, or sell someone the right to watch a movie only once, or sell someone the right to only read a book linearly and not look back in the pages. You know, this sort of thing. Like Siva Vidyanthan calls it the if value then right theory of copyright. That if something has value, there should be a right to it, and therefore a right to exclude people for it, or a right to charge rent for it. And you know, I called it once a kind of particularly boring science fictional adaptation of the Book of Numbers. You know, like this kind of tedious enumeration of all the things people do with information and ways we could charge them money for it. And for a long time, you know, prominent influential economists were calculating the potential value of this, you know, in the trillions. And I think that lawmakers really got snake oil fever, that they, you know, without realizing that there is no effective way, once you've given me the file, to tell me what to do with it, you know, in thinking that there is a way to remove the feature from the computer that lets you do something with the file that you haven't paid for, lawmakers, policymakers allowed themselves to be lulled into this dream, the dream of the WTO, right? The information is oil dream, of infinitely slicing information. And now the irony is that the more information technology you have, the more ICT you have, the harder it is to control how people use information, because the more widely diffused knowledge about how to use computers and therefore knowledge about how to remove restrictions becomes, right? You know, in the 70s, when only a few people knew how to use computers, if you plunk someone down in front of a Altair or an Apple II Plus that was locked in some way and said, you know, here is an ebook that you can only read linearly. In order to read it nonlinearly, you have to reverse engineer the floppy disk, because we've introduced a defect into it that causes it to only be read in one way or something. Most punters, you know, couldn't use it, couldn't do that. But now, not only are there more people than ever who know how to affect the reversal of the restriction, how to subvert the restriction, but we also have this very handy global information network where you can type in, how do I remove this restriction, period, return, and up comes Google with the answer to removing the restriction. So the plausibility of the information gold theory has been in steep decline, even as the policy commitment to the information as gold theory or information as oil theory has been on the rise. And so we're kind of reaching the kind of the breaking point, I think, between the pipe dream of information as oil and the reality of information as air. You know, impossible to control and all around us, and shared.
So does that mean, you know, it's kind of a hopeful future? Or are there forces of good other than copyright lawyers and really bad policymakers to make the internet more free and to kind of stop this kind of antiquated, outdated view of information as oil?
Well, so the good news is that, like, every day that goes by, more people join the cause. Because every day that goes by, more people realize that information and information technology is key to living their lives, key to something that matters to them. So, you know, my grandmother, you know, geeks always rubbish their grandmothers, and I don't know why. Grandmothers are very nice people and smart and fine. You know, my grandmother wasn't a computer user, but not because she's foolish or naive, but because she's like in her mid-80s and she had better things to do with her, you know, years left on Earth than watch progress bars, right? And then she had a great-granddaughter, my daughter, who lived thousands of miles from her. My family's in Toronto. I'm in London. And the only way she could see her for more than a couple of weeks that we're back in Canada every year was to figure out Skype. So she just got a computer and figured out Skype, because it's only Skype. It's easy. And now she's on our side, because information fights now are not abstract fights about bytes and bits. They're very concrete fights about her ability to go on hanging out with her great-granddaughter. And that's a microcosm for something that happens all over the world. A great book I've just read, Black Code, by Ron Deibert, who runs the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He talks about the fact that the fastest growing computer penetration is in the poorest nations on Earth. Right? So this is that there are people all over the world, not just, you know, rich, comfortable people, but also everybody, who rely on computers. And people who know how to use computers get a superpower, which is the ability to organize with each other very cheaply. And that's literally superhuman in the sense that when you do something with someone else, you transcend the limits of one person. You become superhuman. And we've always had the ability to be superhuman because we've always had the ability to work with people. But we've always had to pay a tax, the transaction costs of coordinating our efforts with other people, making sure that we're not, working across purposes, that we aren't, that we're still in lockstep. And that price has been paid in lots of ways. It's paid in meetings and in phone calls and in email chains and in governments and hierarchies and in the lack of initiative, right? The taking away of individual initiative in the service of a greater efficiency. And what computers do is they make that transaction cost much, much lower. And so I'm optimistic, right? Because when you have an ever-increasing pool of people who find it ever easier to work together, who have more and more reasons to care about the health of the internet, that's something to be optimistic about. But I'm pessimistic because I feel like if we don't get off our butts and do something with these superpowers, that there's nothing about the inherent to the internet that keeps it free. When John Gilmore said the internet interprets censorship as damage and routes around it, he didn't mean that it happened automatically. He was talking about the age of Usenet, where Usenet feeds were maintained by individuals who ran UUCP hosts. And when a connection went down, whether due to censorship or due to damage, those UUCP hosts would go and find other routes and route around them. And so what he meant was not that the internet has the innate ability to keep it free, but that the internet has people in positions of stewardship who believe in the mission of keeping the internet around and alive, who can, in the face of damage or censorship, find routes around it. And so if we care about the internet, I feel like we have the tools to keep it free. I don't think we will automatically care about the internet or automatically use those tools. But if we do, we have a chance to use them well.
It's quite interesting thing about Skype, because my mom's favorite line is, "I don't need a computer, I have a pencil." But she's in Timmins, and the only way we like to see each other face-to-face most of the time is via Skype, via my brother's iPad, which is quite interesting. So maybe she'll change her mind.
Right. Well, if you next time you want your mom to get worked up about something involving the internet, don't make it about the internet. Make it about your ability to see each other.
You gave the sense about science lecture, and you're obviously very clued in, and you write lots of things on the internet and books and things. So what are you up to next?
Oh, well, so I'm doing a bunch more speaking. I'm in Hay this weekend at the How the Light Gets In Festival at Hay on Y, and then I'm in Winnipeg at the Canadian Library Association, and then I'm talking at Index on Censorship and the Stoke Newington Literary Festival. I've got a bunch of UK books out, so I'm doing a lot of kind of what you might call whoring around for that. I'm working on a novella for Neal Stephenson and Arizona State University's project, the Hieroglyph Project, which is meant to use real science to inspire in science fiction to inspire people to think about careers in science and the value that science can bring. And I'm writing a story about 3D printers on the moon that are landed by hobbyists and that print out lunar habitats. After that, I'm working on a prequel to my first novel, Down or Not in the Magic Kingdom, about the a moment of post-scarcity revolution, of the scarcity in the midst of post-scarcity when automation obviates all labor, but economics means that in the absence of the need for human labor, no one has any money. And so even though there's no longer any need for scarcity, there's also no ability to acquire goods. There's horrible scarcity in the midst of non-scarcity. So I'm going to be writing this novel, and it's mostly going to be about how in a crisis, people generally behave themselves very well, even though the story that we tell ourselves is about people behaving very badly. That, Cormac McCarthy's The Road is a horrible libel on the human race, that when the lights go out, we won't start alternately eating and raping each other, but we'll in fact probably take good care of each other.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us. It was a pleasure.
Oh, not at all. Nice chatting.
And that's it. If you'd like to find out more about the Podillusion, just head over to podillusion.co.uk. There you also find a link to Corey's full lecture from the Guardian Science podcast. Thanks for listening.